Hello and welcome to another edition of Cooper Talks. And for this one, I'm beginning a series of talks about the Cold War. So again, this is kind of aimed at a broad overview of the Cold War for people that may be generally interested, or specifically those doing GCSE or IGCSE and studying or revising the Cold War, what it was about, who was to blame, and the key events and details. So, yeah, there'll be a few of these episodes to come. I'm going to look at it more chronologically. Sometimes I know it's taught thematically, looking at the origins, who's to blame for the Cold War, then looking at the US policy of containment, and then Soviet expansion, or vice versa, which may well be how it's taught. But I think to try and help make it clear and make sense, I'm just going to look at it chronologically, going through the whole history of the Cold War up until the collapse of the Soviet Union. So where did it all begin? Or how did it all begin? I think the Cold War can be a challenging concept because effectively, when is a war not a war? When it's a Cold War. When you've got these two big combatants going at each other, but never actually directly fighting each other. Now, what's going on with all this? Okay, the fundamental to understanding the Cold War is that it's a basic conflict between capitalism and communism. So it's really important to make sure you understand the differences between these two ideologies and why the two sides distrusted each other. If you understand that, then the whole conflict becomes a lot more straightforward and simple. So when we talk about capitalism, what do we mean? Capitalism, which is tied very much to an idea of democracy, which I'll come back to, really focuses on the individual. It's about individual freedoms, the right for individuals to be able to pursue their own lives. Famously, the Declaration of Independence in America, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, meaning individual gain, and linked with that, the ability to create wealth. So wealth creation, seen as a way of motivating people, basically the view that people are selfish, and not necessarily in a bad way, but that they can, you know, people are motivated to do great things and achieve great things in the desire to achieve a better or happier life. So they can set up companies and make money for themselves and then invest it. And the idea is it's a big cycle of wealth creation and leads to technological and social advancement. Linked with that is the idea of choice, that you are free to make choices at a basic level in the shops. You can choose what food to buy or which clothes to buy, what fashions or styles or trends you follow, things like that. So it's about freedom and choice. There's an idea that society will be inherently unequal, but that gives people a chance to socially advance, that you can, you know, if you work hard and thanks to education, you can advance, you can move up the social ladder equally. If you don't work hard or if you're lazy, then you may go down the social ladder. But the idea is that you can progress and achieve. And it's all based around individual rewards. So at a basic level, think about, you know, why do people work hard? They work hard to get a bigger house or go on better holidays or have a better car, a bigger TV, things like that. It's all about individual rewards for yourself and your family. So capitalism really prioritizes the individual and competition. Communism, on the other hand, is an ideology that emphasizes social responsibility. So instead of individual freedom, everyone is responsible for each other. And that wealth of a nation or a region should be distributed fairly and equally amongst everyone. So it's not so much about wealth creation as wealth distribution. Because everyone is meant to be the same and live in community with each other, communism, there's a focus on uniformity, that there shouldn't be choice, because choice leads to some people having a better thing than other people. So it's about uniformity, a lack of choice. And this, therefore, instead of social advancement, leads to social equality. Everyone is the same. Everyone gets the same regardless of what job they do or how they work or who they were born to and things like that. And instead of individual rewards, they pursue societal rewards. So it's about the glory of the society, glory of the community, glory of the area. So they do things for the community, not for themselves individually. So that's the fundamental clash between capitalism and communism. At a very basic level, well, that's a fast car outside. Anyway, at a very basic level, you have, think of it like a 100-meter race. Capitalism would have everyone starting in the same starting place, so there's no limits or restrictions. And then based on your own hard work and skill, if you win, you win. So the fastest person wins and they get the glory and the rewards. So that means there's winners, but at the same time, there will be losers. Communism as an ideology would look to stagger the race to make sure that everyone finishes at the same point. So they give advantages to some, disadvantages to other people. And while everyone would start at different points, they would ensure everyone finishes at the same place. So in communism, there are no losers, but there are no winners either. And that's kind of where we get a fundamental difference between the two. Now, then it comes to democracy. And as a concept, quite important, particularly for the start of the Cold War, to understand that democracy means different things to different people. Now, in the West, today and during the Cold War, capitalism had a view of democracy that focuses on individuals, individual rights, individual freedoms. So human rights, freedoms, liberties. People get the choice of who they want to lead them. They can choose the government and remove the government that's overseeing them. All about this idea of a social contract. So that's very much the Western view of democracy. Now, under communism, the idea is that the government acts for everyone, it acts for the people, and the leaders are the best people, bit vague about who best is, but never mind, and they will govern in the wider interests of society. And that's why a lot of communist states have democratic in their titles, and things like, you know, today the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, or the Democratic People's Republic of China, things like that. So they both believe that they have democracy. Capitalism and communism both believe in democracy, but they have very different ideas of what democracy means. Democracy is just power of the people. Capitalism would say that's about the power of the people to choose how they're led and how they're governed. Communism would say, well, communist states are all about people power because that's the nature of communism and everyone living in the community. So again, there's a different interpretation about what democracy means. That sort of explains or helps to explain part of the start of the Cold War. Now, before the Cold War started, there was a bit of a history of ideological fears and hostility between both the USA and USSR. So the Cold War didn't just suddenly erupt at the end of World War II from nowhere. From the USA's point of view, they had a real fear of communism as an ideology. America is built on capitalism, it's about built on individual liberty. So the idea of a communist uprising that would seize property and take away individual rights and liberties was a terrifying prospect. So they were naturally feared and scared of communism far more than most European democracies were, because America was built fundamentally on individual rights and liberties, and communism seemed to undermine that principle. America, particularly in the 1920s, was a society based on business and business leaders, you know, the famous people like Rockefeller and Carnegie and so on. And during the Soviet revolution, the communist revolution in 1917 in Russia, and the ensuing civil war, business leaders and the wealthy had been executed. So obviously a lot of the people in power and status positions were very worried about the prospect of communism taking control around the world. And of course, there was a big fear for the impact on trade. And although during the 1920s, America had been isolationist, it had realised the folly of this in the 1930s and 1940s. And they feared that if many states became communist, then they would cease to trade with the world. And that could have an impact on America's ability to create wealth, buying and selling goods, buying goods from other countries or selling them to those other countries as well. So they were scared that if communism expanded, that would impact on their trade. And of course, America is built on these individual democratic principles, and they feared that communism would be an attack on their democracy. And of course, there is a long-term kind of a basic degree of racism or fear coming out of the USA. They feared the Slavic races. There was kind of Eastern Europeans were seen as alien. There was a degree of distrust simply because it was foreign. Now, what about the USSR? Well, during that revolution of 1917-20, the USA, along with Britain and France, had actually invaded Russia to support the white forces who were opposed to the red Bolsheviks who were seizing power. And although they didn't really make much difference, the USSR had memories of this invasion and of the USA in particular, although it was mainly Britain who led the troops, the USA supporting counter-revolution and trying to stop communism from establishing itself before it had even begun. The USSR also had memories of appeasement where the USA did nothing and Britain and France had basically appeased fascist leaders in the hope that communism and fascism would end up in a fight to the death. So they didn't trust the West. They felt that the West would be likely to sell them out. During the 1920s in America, you had a series of Red Scares where communist members of the Communist Party or associates or affiliates were persecuted, arrested and challenged. And again, that shows to the USSR that the Americans hate communists and how they might treat the USSR internationally. And again, there's some basic xenophobia, racism. They distrust America as alien, as different, and they see their Slavic or Russian goals as superior. So there's a lot of these long-term fears that were in existence before World War II began. Now, let's think about World War II. The USSR and USA both distrusted each other even before the Cold War began. But thanks to World War II, the USA and USSR had become allies. The enemy of my enemy is my friend, as the famous Sun Tzu quote goes. So that meant they were both unified in their common hostility towards Nazi Germany. So they end up in a situation where they are working together and coordinating and supporting each other's tactics. And although there was a lot of hostility and betrayal in the early years, once Germany declared war on both, they came together and unified and saw each other as allies. But it was only going to exist as long as there was this common enemy. And we see that with the start of the conferences. Now, sorry, I realise I've been talking for nearly a quarter of an hour and we've only just got to the actual start of the Cold War. But really, we can start the Cold War from the conferences. Now, there were three main conferences. I know for some courses, you only need to know about the last two. So don't panic if you've never heard of the Tehran Conference. But I just want to tell you a little bit about it for a bit of context. Now, the Tehran Conference, Tehran in Iran, which was seen as neutral territory, was the first meeting between the big three. The big three being Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of the UK, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or FDR, from America, and Joseph Stalin from the USSR. And Tehran was sort of neutral territory, nominally under British American control, but technically neutral, but it also bordered the Soviet Union. So 1943, although the tide of war is turning at this stage, it's still not clear who was going to win or how the war was going to be won. So there's this big set piece where they finally meet. And at this point, with a mutual enemy and the main priority being defeating Nazi Germany, strong bonds can be developed and are developed, particularly between FDR and Joseph Stalin, where they start making agreements and building this personal relationship in the struggle against Nazi Germany. Churchill was there, but of course Britain was a much weaker country at this point, and Churchill did have a history of being very anti-communist. So in the Tehran Conference of 1943, there were some key agreements. There was an agreement that Britain and America would open a second front in Western Europe to try and divide the Nazi forces to take some of the pressure off the Soviet Union, who were fighting after Stalingrad and Kursk and pushing the Nazis back. That once Germany was defeated, the USSR would join in the attack against Japan and bring their forces to bear against the Japanese threat in the Pacific. So it is worth bearing in mind at this stage in 1943, the USSR wasn't involved in fighting in the Pacific. They all agreed that a United Nations would be created and learn from the mistakes of the Cold War, the League of Nations, and that the boundaries of Poland would be shifted west to try and create a buffer state and compensate the USSR for some of its losses. There were still some disagreements. Stalin felt annoyed because there was still a delay to the Second Front being opened up. Churchill was very hesitant to commit to France until he knew which way the war was going to go. Although they did fight in North Africa, they kept delaying the Western Front. Eventually, they take on Italy, but again, that wasn't good enough for Stalin. So he's feeling that, a bit like with appeasement, the West is leaving it to the Soviet Union and the communists to basically deal with the Nazi threat. Churchill always been suspicious of Stalin and communism. Back in the 1917 to 20 period, he'd actually said he wanted to strangle communism at birth. And Stalin remembers these sorts of things. And there was a big issue of in Poland, the Warsaw Uprising, when the Red Army actually halted near Warsaw. The people of Warsaw rose up as a revolt against Nazi rule. The Nazis crushed these political opponents, and only then did the Red Army go in. And it was believed and felt that this was basically Stalin allowing the Nazis to deal with future potential opponents rather than going in and liberating them. So that caused a degree of distrust. So that was the first conference. And again, don't worry if you haven't studied that. You may well not need to for your course, particularly if you're doing IGCSE. However, we then get forward to the next conference with it, which is at Yalta. Yalta in Crimea, which was part of the Soviet Union at this point. And that's in February 1945. And again, context is key here. By February 1945, it is very clear that the Nazis are going to lose. The Second Front has been opened up. We've had D-Day in June 1944. Germany itself has been invaded. And the Nazis are being pushed right back and are going to be defeated. So although the war is still going on, they are starting to turn their eyes to peace. Now, it's the same big three meeting at Yalta as met in Tehran. So we've got Churchill, FDR and Stalin with that personal relationship. The agreements were largely similar. But on top of that, now that it was clear that Germany was going to be defeated, and France, having been liberated, was now part of the Allied forces as well. They agreed that Germany and Berlin would be divided into four separate zones, each controlled by one of the Allied states. Having discovered the concentration camps and death camps of the Holocaust, it was agreed that Nazi war criminals would be put on trial. And they all agreed, and this is crucial, that there would be free elections for liberated countries, and they'd be able to choose how they would be governed. So there was this agreement introduced at this stage. And it was also agreed between FDR and Stalin that Eastern Europe would be a Soviet sphere of influence. Now, what that meant was the Soviet Union would sort of oversee and keep an eye on what was going on there. But that didn't necessarily, as far as FDR considered, mean they would have complete control over Eastern Europe. They wouldn't be able to impose things. I think FDR probably thought it would be a bit like America seeing Central and South America as under their sphere of influence, something they maybe don't control it directly, but they need to be consulted about what's going on there. So not direct control. Stalin took that slightly differently, as we shall see, and thought it meant the Soviets could have total control over the area. And also Churchill had promised something called proposed his percentages deal, which kind of seems really odd, where he sort of apparently suggested to Stalin that, you know, Stalin could have 90% control over Poland and Britain would have 10% control. And then in Greece, Britain would have 90% control and the Soviet Union would have 10%. Hungary would be 50-50. And you can't have 90% control versus 10% control. But again, there's an argument that Stalin took this to mean that Churchill was agreeing to him having control over key states in Eastern Europe. Because Churchill was just massively obsessed with Greece. Just loved Greece. I think that's the dangers of having a classical education. Okay, so there were still some major disagreements at Yalta. The main ones being about whether Germany should be forced to pay reparations. You've got the British and Americans looking at the war and saying, you know what, after World War One, Treaty of Versailles, huge reparations that led to the Nazis and basically led here. Maybe we should just learn from that and not have any reparations. But of course, they suffered far, far less in terms of damage and disruption than the Soviet Union. Just the number of people killed in the Soviet Union dwarfed anything from America or Britain. And same with the cities completely wiped out and destroyed. Yes, Britain had had the Blitz, but nothing like the destruction of Eastern Europe. And Stalin was determined that someone should pay for that, mainly Germany. And there was disagreement over exactly how Poland would be governed and operated. So we can see that tensions are starting to emerge and grow, although they are still unified by a common enemy. And then we get to July 1945 and the Potsdam Conference. Now, at this stage, Germany has been defeated. Potsdam is a town just to the south of Berlin. Obviously, Berlin was in a bit of a mess at this stage. So that's the first big one. The Nazis have now been defeated, although the war is still going on over in the Pacific and with Japan. The other big change at the start of the conference is that FDR has died since Yalta and he's been replaced by Harry Truman. Now, this is really important. For a start, Truman didn't have the personal relationship with Stalin from the height of the Second World War. So there's no common bond there. Truman had also been kept at quite a distance by Roosevelt. So when he became president, didn't really know what had been agreed or hadn't been agreed. And that meant Stalin would say, oh, I was promised influence and things here. And Truman didn't necessarily believe him or act on that. So there's a level of distrust. And also Truman was very much anti-communist. And he was opposed to anything that would see communist control and domination. And he wants to promote democratic principles as he sees it. So, and he's much more militarily aggressive than Roosevelt had been. So there's a big shift and a big change coming on here. The other thing that happens during the war, during the conference, is that the British changed prime minister. Britain had agreed, or the House of Parliament had passed a law saying they wouldn't have an election until Germany was defeated. Now, Germany had been defeated, but Japan was still being fought. But by the laws passed by Parliament, the election had to happen. And famously, Clement Attlee and the Labour Party won a landslide majority. And therefore, Clement Attlee, who had been part of Winston Churchill's war cabinet and was an important member of it, again replaces Churchill halfway through the conference. Now, Attlee's got a number of issues. One being that he knows Britain is basically bankrupt and he wants to fund the big welfare state. So he's going to need American investment and money. But also as a socialist, he's kind of got sympathies for the communists. Also, he's not quite the strong, bombastic personality that Churchill was. So Attlee very much becomes kind of a spare wheel at the Potsdam Conference. Now, there's a lot of agreement still at Yalta about, Potsdam, following on the idea of, creating a United Nations, putting Nazi war criminals on trial, Germany being divided into four zones and Berlin equally being divided into four zones. They also managed to agree to demilitarize Germany. The Germany will have no military and will basically be occupied by the various forces for the foreseeable future. And they all agreed to re-establish democracy in Germany. But again, the key is they have different views about what democracy is. Just the same, they all agreed to allow democracy in the Eastern European liberated states. However, different ideas about what democracy is. They agreed that there should be some reparations paid to the Allies. However, they disagreed over how this was to be carried out and conducted. And they all agreed to ban the Nazi Party. However, big disagreements. The big disagreement was about what to do with Germany in the long run, whether to unify it and allow it to become an independent state again and start trading, or whether to completely destroy it, how it was going to be occupied, where its borders would be. There was no sense of agreement. And that, again, reflects the very different concerns and priorities that had happened during the war. And they also disagreed about the need to have free and fair elections and what that actually meant, and whether some places that had already chosen to go communist or chosen to go democratic should be allowed to choose that, how these would be carried out and conducted. And although Although there was still in principle that the Soviet Union would declare war on Japan, there was a fear now that with the war in the Pacific almost being won, Japan had been pushed back to the Japanese mainland, or the Japanese islands, that if Russia now got involved, they will be able to have a stake in the running of the Pacific territories and how that was gone. So there was kind of pressure on Truman to try and finish the war in the Pacific rapidly. And this led to perhaps the most significant thing that happened in Potsdam, and that was Truman's order to drop the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, there's a whole debate about this, why Truman did it. One of the debates is that having found out the Manhattan Project, which developed nuclear weapons, had been a success, he wanted to test these bombs straight away and send a message to the Soviet Union and show them the power and scale of this new weaponry that they had, almost as a warning to Stalin. Stalin tried to front it out, but obviously was worried about how the Americans might use this in the future against the Soviet Union. And this is going to trigger the Soviets to start stepping up the development of nuclear weapons. It's going to change the nature of warfare. And that's going to lead to a greater degree of mistrust. It obviously brings the war with Japan to a rapid conclusion before the Soviets get there. So again, we see kind of distrust of each other coming through, as well as the start of the nuclear arms race, and the fact that the Americans have the atomic bomb and the Soviets don't, will start to sour the relationship between the two in these early years. So that's the conferences, and I've been going for about 26 minutes. That's quite a lot and very small part of the course, I admit, but a lot of background and information. Next time I will look at what happened between 1945 up to 1949 with the communist expansion, Marshall Plan, and ultimately the Berlin blockade. I hope this has been useful. I hope you're doing okay, and thank you very much for listening. I will speak to you again soon. Take care. Bye.